You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last month, Dr. David Nabarro, the UN Special Envoy on the Ebola crisis, told the General Assembly there are now 10 times fewer people diagnosed with Ebola each week than there were in September last year. And the New York Times reported this week that after months of declining cases, there's hope that the Ebola outbreak might finally be ending. This is good news for the nations of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone in particular, where the vast majority of the 24,701 cases and 10,194 deaths have occurred. Sean Casey, head of International Medical Corps' response team, was on the front lines in West Africa fighting the outbreak, and he's here to discuss his experiences with the virus. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
Weren't you recently in Ghana?
I was in Ghana.
You've been based in Liberia. Why Ghana? Have there been cases there?
No, we had a regional conference in Ghana last week. I'm based in Liberia, but I'm covering Guinea, Sierra Leone, Mali, Guinea-Bissau. So I'm traveling a lot within the region.
Despite the good news, there was a total of 150 new Ebola cases reported in the week ending March 15th. That's the highest in this year. Do we know where most of these new cases are coming from?
Mostly in Guinea, some in Sierra Leone. The caseload in Liberia has dropped really significantly. We only have one case at the moment, but there's quite a few cases around Conakry right now, the capital of Guinea, and that's worrying us. It's a very densely populated city, and there's a lot of community resistance in Guinea that is leading to transmission that goes undetected and burials that go undetected and that aren't done safely.
Community resistance, aren't people aware by now that this is a fatal disease?
Not everybody. I mean, there's a lot of publicity about Ebola. There's billboards and radio shows and all kinds of things. People hear about it, but they don't necessarily believe it. So there's political elements to this. It's an election year in Guinea. There's some distrust of the government in certain places. And that links back to how people react to the outbreak.
And then there is a resistance based on old cultural traditions.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of people don't understand the basics of virology and how viruses are transmitted, the importance of hygiene. But a lot of the transmission happens in funerals, which are very sensitive everywhere in the world. Burying the dead safely in an Ebola outbreak means that people in PPE, in protective gear, come and take the body away. It's somewhat unceremonious. And people are resistant to that. It's a deep-seated cultural practice.
The Economist reported that, and I'm quoting, officials with the UN and the World Health Organization have cautioned that ending the outbreak entirely would be extremely difficult. In particular, getting to their goal of zero cases by mid-April. Do you see that as happening?
It's not going to happen. We're still seeing active transmission, and in the last couple of weeks in Guinea, only a third of cases have actually arisen from contact lists. So there's lots of transmission happening that we don't even see.
Mid-April is the rainy season. Does that have an effect?
It might. We're not sure because we haven't seen this situation play out yet. But it does affect population movements.
Because of poor road conditions?
Because of poor road conditions and because of just annual migration patterns related to farming and other things. So we're not sure how it's going to play out. It might limit our access to certain areas and make following up on cases more difficult or transport of cases more difficult to Ebola treatment centers.
Coincidentally, in today's New York Times, there were three separate stories about Ebola. What do you make of the fact that a new genetic analysis of Ebola published in the journal Science offers encouraging evidence that doomsday is not nigh?
Well, I mean, what we don't know about Ebola is how it plays out in a large scale like this. We've never seen an outbreak like this. So the early predictions about the caseload, CDC at one point said we would see 1.4 million cases by the end of 2014.
Well, there was fear that there'd be mutation, and even if we were able to handle one kind of Ebola, there'd be many other kinds of Ebola.
Right, and we haven't seen that play out in this outbreak, but we don't know how it's going to react because every previous outbreak has happened basically in the jungle and largely burnt itself out before it was able to spread to a large number of people. And now we have Ebola across three countries, in cities and in rural areas, affecting a significant number of people. So we're learning as we go in this outbreak. And I think what we're seeing is that it's not as bad as we expected it might be at the end of last year. But we're also getting close to zero in Liberia, but not quite there. And in Guinea, we're still seeing quite a lot of transmission. So while we're not seeing the doomsday scenario that was predicted, we're still in a pretty dangerous situation.
What did you make of all of the what looks now like hysteria that occurred last fall when Dr. Craig Spencer, a 33-year-old Doctors Without Borders volunteer, was diagnosed with Ebola and was here in New York. Mm-hmm. He had taken several rides in the subway, even gone bowling when he was beginning to be symptomatic. You were in Liberia at the time, but were you hearing about that and the responses of Governor Chris Christie and Andrew Cuomo here, also in Maine, Governor Paul LePage? Did you see that as serious stuff or as political stuff?
Well, we saw it as kind of mirroring what happened in West Africa, because Ebola being introduced into an environment where it had never been before causes some panic. When I got to Liberia in August last year, there were bodies in the streets. And when people had previously said, you know, this is not going to be a big problem, we saw it turn into a big problem. So I think on the heels of that, we saw cases in the U.S., and it's something that we had never seen before, and we weren't sure how it would be handled. And so there was some fear around it. But the reality is the case was isolated. Craig Spencer was isolated very quickly and didn't end up infecting others. So it can be managed. It's just about having the right infection prevention and control procedures in place.
My guest is Sean Casey, head of International Medical Corps Response Team, which provides humanitarian relief on the front lines of conflict and natural disasters in nearly 40 countries. In addition to Mr. Casey's work in West Africa, he's also led emergency responses in Haiti, South Sudan, and the Philippines, and in war and crisis zones around the world. We'll get to some of that in a little while. Every new case of Ebola has to be tracked back to zero, doesn't it?
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, we have to trace every single contact that a case has had. So, you know, the idea is that when you have a single person that's a case, you trace every single contact that they've had since they became symptomatic, and you can follow those people every single day, see if they develop symptoms, and if they do, quickly isolate them, and that's how you get it back to zero. The problem right now is that we're struggling, in Guinea in particular, to find those contacts, either because people are not reporting them or because they're disappearing. In some cases, health workers are not even able to access communities because there's so much resistance.
But I'd imagine anywhere people might be reluctant to tell you about all of their contacts. Some of them could be rather embarrassing.
Sure. And people don't remember all of their contacts. If I asked you to tell me every single person that you've seen in the last 21 days, it would be difficult. So especially when you're in a city. And you're walking down the street and you're seeah people and you're shaking hands, it's difficult to find every contact. And that's why we all feared since the beginning what happens when Ebola gets to a densely populated urban context.
A listener called in to say that she heard from her doctor that Ebola persists in the semen for 3 months after a person has been cured. Mm-hmm. So unless there's abstinence for 3 months, that person can pass it on?
Abstinence or protected sex, yes. And we've seen this play out recently with a couple of cases, one in Guinea and probably one recently in Liberia. It requires us to look more closely at how we deal with men who recover and make sure that they and their partners are informed about the risk and that they take the necessary precautions.
The Ebola treatment facility you set up in Liberia was actually in the forest next to a leper colony.
Right.
In your first month, you treated over 100 Ebola patients. And surprisingly, some of your health workers, none of your health workers got sick, but a modern hospital in Dallas had infections. How were you able to keep your health workers safe?
Right. International Medical Corps arrived in Liberia in August, and we had never worked in Ebola before. So we had to learn everything from scratch. And we learned from Doctors Without Borders, and then basically trained our teams and scaled it up. But it's all about protocols. It's about having the right equipment, which we call PPE, personal protective equipment. And it's about knowing how to take it off safely, really, more than anything else.
Taking off that hazmat suit.
Right. It's a 20-plus step process. You have to
are some of the mistakes that might be made?
Well, people might touch their face, or they may not adequately wash their hands between steps. You know, Ebola patients produce a lot of fluid, so blood and vomit and all kinds of things. And so workers, health workers, who interact with them end up with bodily fluids on their hands, and they have to make sure that they wash their hands thoroughly inside the Ebola treatment unit, and particularly when they're doffing their equipment.
At one point when the hysteria was rising in this country, there were calls to stop flights between the African nations most affected and the United States. Was there any legitimate reason to enact such a ban?
Well, I think adequate screening at points of exit can prevent the spread through travel in most cases. What was more important from our perspective was that we were able to get our staff and our supplies to West Africa. There are currently only two airlines flying to Liberia a couple times a week, and it was really challenging to get staff deployed early on because of the flight limitations. It created an operational reality of not enough flights, but also a psychological barrier for people deploying to West Africa, not knowing if the two remaining airlines back in October would cancel their flights, and then we'd really be stuck.
How do you get people to give up a life of comfort in the United States and other countries in the West to devote themselves to dangerous work like this?
They usually come to us. We have a huge network of volunteers who respond to emergencies all over the world. International Medical Corps has responded to almost every major emergency in the last 30 years, and we have a pool of doctors and nurses who we rely on for these responses, and they really stepped up in this response.
Are you in competition with Doctors Without Borders?
We're in partnership and collaboration with Doctors Without Borders. They trained us in this response, and they were calling on additional partners to come in because they didn't have the capacity to manage the cases. And International Medical Corps was the first partner to step up. We opened our Ebola treatment unit in Liberia on September 15th and another one on November 22nd and two more in Sierra Leone in December. And they taught us how to do that. And then in turn, we ended up teaching many other organizations how to do it.
In your opinion, what were some of the lessons learned from the Ebola outbreak, things that should have been done differently, at least at first?
Don't let it get big is the primary lesson. I mean, I think...
Well, we had had outbreaks before and they didn't get big.
So right, because they were in the forest. Well, they were in the forest in the Congo or South Sudan or Uganda, and they were isolated and kind of burnt themselves out. We didn't collectively, globally, respond to this fast enough, and we just didn't move fast enough to isolate the cases before it got to cities.
The first image on your website brings to attention the difficulties every woman women face mm-hmm. in providing clean water for their families. Where did you find that to be most true?
Well, I mean, in Guinea, for example, I was at a hospital a couple of weeks ago that hasn't had water in the hospital for 20 years. I mean, across Africa, there's challenges with access to clean water and safe water. And
do they truck it in?
They have to walk to a well down the road and carry it up by bucket. And so, you know, we're advancing infection prevention control procedures in health facilities and telling people to wash their hands. But there are basic barriers to those messages translating into actions.
And then there's the problem of all those children who have been orphaned as a result of Ebola.
There's a lot. Ebola affects children more than other populations in two ways. Almost all children under 5 that get Ebola die. We've had only a couple of survivors.
Just don't have a strong enough immune system?
We're not sure exactly why. We did have one, I think the youngest Ebola survivor ever was one of our patients, a 3-month-old girl called Josephine. Her mother survived first, and then Josephine survived and was discharged a couple of weeks later. But almost all children that get the virus die. But also, we've seen this virus rip through families. Many times throughout the course of this outbreak, we've had entire families admitted together.
Test results on the vaccine have been really encouraging, 600 volunteers and no problems. How would that be applied if this vaccine winds up being accepted as something to be used with Ebola?
Well, I think if it works and it's proven to be effective, it'll first probably go out to health workers. Ebola affects health workers more than any other specific population because they come into contact with bodily fluid the most. So that would probably be the first population to get the vaccine. And then gradual scale-up would follow, but it's difficult. I mean, we've had treatment for malaria for decades, and we're still not able to get it out everywhere. So there's definitely challenges even if we have a vaccine that works.
But hasn't this vaccine been in existence for at least a decade and not really used because most of the people who got Ebola were poor?
Well, I think they were poor and they were also in very remote locations. So the previous outbreaks have really been deep in the jungle, and they've burnt themselves out relatively quickly. So I think it's a matter of timing as well as a matter of isolation.
I'm talking with Sean Casey, head of International Medical Corps' response team. We will continue our conversation, talk about some of the crises in other parts of the world after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Sean Casey, head of International Medical Corps' response team, and we've been talking about Ebola. We will be talking about some other things as well, but the Ebola crisis right now is something that is a major concern, and we have gotten a call in from somebody who is from Liberia, Suma, now in Manhattan. Suma, has anybody you know been affected by Ebola?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I have quite a good number of friends and some family members that were infected, lost some, at least two or three of them survived. I'm actually from Sierra Leone and close to the Guinea border.
That's ground zero, isn't it?
Excuse me?
That's really where the worst problems have occurred.
Exactly. But the opposite end of the Guinea border, that's where the Ebola occurred. But I'm on the northern part, and this one happened on the east. But there are three fundamental reasons why the issue when the Ebola outbreak went out of control, particularly with respect to the lack of cooperation that the aid agencies were not receiving from the community. One is because it is the first time in the history of that community for any outbreak of any nature to be so dangerous and lethal and spread so wide and far. That's the first experience. There is no record in the history of our lifetime that such an outbreak has happened. Secondly, it's coming out of the fact that it is rumored, which is some people have substantiated it, that Tulane University was conducting an Ebola research at that particular zone area where the outbreak occurred. So people are of the opinion, including myself, that this is a biomedical research mistake that may have happened by Tulane University when they were doing a test, because it was actually on their website when they noted that they are doing a research boasting about it right prior to the outbreak of the Ebola crisis.
Simba, can I stop you for a moment? Because
yes.
When HIV/AIDS became a serious problem, we heard similar things again coming out of Africa. Do you think that every time there is a major medical emergency, it's because the United States has been testing out its research on Africans?
No, that's not what I'm saying. If you go to Tulane University website and do your research and look on their website, you find something relating to Ebola, which some of us have written letters to the effect. I don't know if they've taken it down.
Well,
so this is not
Sean,
coming out of some rumor.
Sean, you've heard this before. Mm-hmm. What is your response?
I mean, I've heard this, like you said, about HIV as well. I used to work on HIV in Africa for a number of years. Ebola... the scientific evidence indicates that Ebola is a zoonotic disease that exists in animals like bats and chimpanzees. The likely scenario for the start of this outbreak, the one that I believe, is that, as researchers indicated, that a child was playing in a tree in eastern Guinea, a tree in which bats were living and sleeping, and probably came into contact with bats or with bat feces. And then became infected, and then passed it on to his mother and the rest of his family, and it kind of carried on from there. I think this is why we'll probably see it again, because the disease exists in the animal population. But I think, you know, there's often rumors like this, and in all three countries there are committees specifically designated to try to combat these rumors, because they do make the response more difficult in some cases.
Okay, well, Suma, we've heard two sides of that story. What's the third thing?
No, well, the third thing has to do with the fact that it's the way to avoid the spread of Ebola goes right through our cultural practices when we want to say goodbye to the dead, you know, and that's the time people are emotionally down and they want to show how much they have loved and they're going to miss the person. So it was a little difficult for people to be controlled or encouraged to avoid having to go through that same processes, especially when they were still having their doubts. But I'm sure now those information have been well educated and it's under control, and that's why we're seeing all the improvement that we're experiencing now.
Well, I mean, I think that we've seen that play out for sure in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And I think what happened in Liberia and Sierra Leone when I arrived in August and saw bodies in the streets and saw ambulances driving up and down looking for a bed for patients, the national psyche changed. People really realized that this is a legitimate threat, that it's real, and they changed their behaviors. So for the first months that I was in West Africa, I didn't shake anybody's hand, didn't hug anybody, didn't kiss anybody. And that was true of almost everybody there. In Guinea, that switch never happened. There was never a moment where we didn't have a tipping point in Guinea that led to the public changing behaviors. So everybody still shakes hands. People still go to funerals. The behaviors haven't changed there. And that's, I think, why we're seeing transmission to this day.
So how do we get past this? This suggests that Ebola will be with us as long as some people ignore the rules, I guess.
Right.
The protocols.
Well, I think there's a few things. Number one, we have to focus on working with communities directly. We have to work on behavior change. I think the way to do that is by partnering with community-based organizations who are in the communities to speak to their friends and their neighbors rather than a top-down approach. I don't think that's going to work. We also have to work on infection prevention control in health facilities. International Medical Corps is now doing this across the region, triaging patients and relatives and staff before they go into a hospital. We saw lots of transmission in health facilities early on, and so that's a priority. And then also, you know, continuing to focus on safe burial and preparedness so that if there is a case, when there is another case, because this will happen again, we're able to respond and isolate that case and keep it at one or two or three rather than 100 or 200 or 300.
Well, there's been turmoil in other parts of Africa. Is it possible that in the area that Boko Haram right now has been affecting, that something like this could also be transmitted?
It's possible. We've seen outbreaks now in the DRC, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in South Sudan, in Uganda, and now in West Africa, which indicates that migration patterns have gone from Central Africa to West Africa for animals that have been infected. So, yes, it's possible. And, you know, as an emergency response agency, International Medical Corps is in places where we've seen crisis inside crisis, and it's always harder to deal with. We've seen polio outbreaks in conflict zones and things like that. It makes it much more difficult to address.
And in a place like Pakistan, where people who are giving the polio vaccine are being killed as a result, that would make eliminating polio there a lot more difficult.
Exactly. I think that's the main barrier, is community resistance. So this speaks to how we have to deal with the Ebola outbreak, but more generally, it's really critical to work with communities and support local health workers and train locals to manage a lot of these activities so that they can build that change from within.
We have a photograph of one of our producers wearing an Ebola protective suit that Sean Casey brought to our studio today. You can find it on our show page at WNYC.org. This is Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm talking with Sean Casey, head of International Medical Corps Response Team. And you have an emergency response team in lots of different places. Haiti, for example, after the devastating earthquake of 2010. Is there still a problem there?
Well, we're still fighting the cholera outbreak there, which has been going since late 2010.
Which was imported by the UN, wasn't
apparently.
It?
Apparently.
And maybe Tulane University, I'm not sure.
I managed the cholera response in Haiti back in 2011, and it's still going. And it links to the same messages that I'm saying about Ebola. It's behavior change, it's basic infrastructure, water and sanitation.
Your organization has led efforts in Syria over the last 4 years. In a war zone, how do you keep your workers safe?
Well, I mean, we work in a lot of conflict zones and in natural disasters, which are risky environments, and we keep them safe by having the right protocols, by making sure that staff are educated on the context in which they're working, and by partnering with local communities.
How do you do that in a place like Syria? What is the local community? Is it do you get the cooperation of President Assad's government? You get the cooperation of some of the rebel groups? And isn't there always a fear, considering what ISIS has done recently, that one of your aid workers is going to be kidnapped and all sorts of terrible things can happen?
I don't personally work on Syria, but I know that we focus a lot on training local health workers. And as a humanitarian organization, International Medical Corps is neutral and impartial. So we're not taking a side in any conflict situation. We're focusing on the health of the populations that we're trying to serve.
Did any of your workers get sick from Ebola?
Not one yet. It's a source of great pride, actually. We've treated over 1,300 patients. We have over 1,300 staff in the region, and we haven't had any infections to date. And that's, as I said, having started out with never having done this before. This was brand new to us. So we're quite proud of that.
Your organization has recently led efforts in the Pacific to provide emergency medical assistance to the victims of Typhoon Pam. Mm-hmm. What are some of the first steps that you take when you're responding to a natural disaster like that?
Well, we deployed a team to Vanuatu. I think organizationally we made the decision in about 20 minutes. We tend to work very fast when a crisis occurs. And we had teams deployed within a couple of days. We're working on some very remote islands that now have only a day or two of food supply left. The water is contaminated because the wells were flooded with salt water. So we've deployed medical teams, and we're focusing on water and sanitation as well.
Do you have your own airplanes to move all of the equipment?
We don't have our own airplanes. No, we don't. We rely on partners for that. So we use commercial aircraft, but we also have great partnerships with a number of corporations and other NGOs and foundations that help us move supplies and people.
And where do you get the funding for all of this? It must be very expensive.
We get funding from a number of sources, from institutional donors, governments, but also from a number of private individuals. So, you know, a lot of people go to our website, internationalmedicalcorps.org, and make donations. And those donations are what allow us to respond quickly.
If the Ebola crisis gets down to a point where we're only seeing one or two cases in a year, will you still be there, or will you just have trained enough people in the affected areas to take care of it for themselves?
We're not going anywhere for now. Even if we have one or two cases, that's still a major concern for us. But it's not just about treating Ebola cases. It's also about building back the health system better than we found it. Because the health system before this outbreak was obviously not able to handle this outbreak. So and in West Africa, these countries face cholera outbreaks, Lassa fever. There's a huge malaria burden. So what we want to do is get beyond Ebola, but then make sure that the health system is able to respond so we don't see an outbreak of this size in the future.
How do you deal with the water problem that you were talking about earlier? I saw a documentary a couple of years ago about some wells that were built that were experimental, that were meant to alleviate the problem. They broke down after a few months, and the people there just lost faith.
Right. I mean, with wells, they require some maintenance and sometimes spare parts for pumps and things like that. So when we do wells, and we do a lot of water and sanitation work globally, including in places like South Sudan and Ethiopia, we often work with local communities to create user groups who are responsible for maintenance and make try to build in sustainability from the beginning.
Judging from the telephone call, there are people who believe that there are problems that the West brings, and the West mm-hmm. has been culpable for all sorts of problems in Africa over a long history of colonialism. How do you get past the suspicion that people may have when you say, I've come here to help you?
You know, we had some resistance to the Ebola treatment units in Liberia early on, and we started doing a lot of community work. We even offered tours to community leaders to come to the Ebola treatment unit and see what it is, to see that we're not experimenting on people, to see that there are sick people from their communities and we're providing them medical care, 3 meals a day, showing them movies every night. We started showing movies every evening. We showed The Lion King, I think, about 20 times. But to show that it's not a scary, awful place, that it's that we're there to help. And I think that that paid great dividends in terms of our ability to identify cases and treat them quickly.
And in the case of Ebola, because the vaccine is still being tested, what is the treatment ultimately? Isolation?
So the treatment is we provide treatment for malaria because there's a very high malaria prevalence anyway. We provide antibiotics to every patient that comes in case they have an underlying bacterial infection. We give them rehydration through oral rehydration solution, ORS, if they're able to drink. And if they're not, we give them IV fluids. There's other experimental treatments that are being used, some medications, blood transfusions, plasma, convalescent serum, a whole range. But those are not scalable at this point in West Africa. So we need to identify which ones work through trials and then find ways to scale them up for future responses.
Does the malaria make people more vulnerable to the Ebola?
We don't know, but possibly. I think a compromised immune system is generally a bad thing. And so, you know, people in many places in West Africa have a history of malnutrition, a history of underlying medical conditions that may have gone untreated, and that could contribute to morbidity.
Sean Casey is the head of International Medical Corps' response team, which provides humanitarian relief on the front lines of conflict and natural disaster in nearly 40 countries. In addition to his work in West Africa, he has led and Central Africa. Mm-hmm. He has led emergency responses in Haiti, South Sudan, the Philippines, and in war crisis zones around the world. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.